Hockey Central at noon is Hockey Central at any time you want it to be. When you subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. On demand. Put down that salad and man up your lunch hour with the best hockey coverage possible. You're listening to Hockey Central on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
It's not how you start, it's how you finish. And the Chicago Blackhawks proved that in Game 1 of the Stanley Cup Final. We welcome you to Hockey Central at noon on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks, along with the NHL Network in the United States. Aaliyah Hextall joined by Gord Stellick and Hall of Famer Scott Morrison. And I'm having trouble even looking at you, Mr. Stellick. Beautiful coral color today. For those of you who are joining us on the Fan 590, you should see this coral that Gord is rocking
today.
It's
the Tampa attitude. It's the Tampa attitude. You know, Games 1 and 2 are there, mm-hmm. So that's it. Summer.
It's beautiful.
Trying to match
you. I was going to wear it today myself. Good thing we didn't. We would have been twinsies. All right. Well, there we go, guys. In spite of strong
start. I had no thoughts of wearing it, so just so you know.
I'm surprised at that, Scotty Mo.
Want to be on the record.
In spite of strong start by Tampa, Chicago, they skate away with Game 1 of the Stanley Cup Final by a score of 2-1. And if you looked at that box score last night, you might have thought that this game was solved in about 2 minutes in the third period when Chicago potted a pair, Teuvo Teravainen along with Antoine Vermette. But it may have been that 13 minutes in which we saw between the second and third, Tampa not even recording a single shot on net. Now, Gord, on Tuesday on Hockey Central before this series start, we talked about Chicago's wealth of experience and Tampa Bay's lack thereof. And we thought that the experience factor would factor in towards the tail end of the series. But did we not see it in Game 1?
Well, absolutely. And certainly the Anaheim Ducks saw it in their series as well. The Chicago Blackhawks are the masters, or one of the few masters, at closing the deal. They've done it. They've won Stanley Cups, and it's a whole different level to get there. And, you know, I have to think the Tampa Bay Lightning played a lot of ways, like they did Game 5, Game 7 against the New York Rangers. And where there, they had one extra goal rather than 1-0. They were up 2-0. But they kind of did that comfortable squeeze, smothered the Rangers, and were in control the whole deal. This one, after a great start by the Lightning, once it was 1-0, I found it a very boring second period. Third period, you can rationalize they were doing the rope-a-dope or whatever it may be, and they got just minutes away from actually holding on. But they were holding on for dear life. And Chicago, as they've done, as Taves did a couple of times against Anaheim, as they did against Boston the time they won the Stanley Cup, just turn around and look and you go, what the hell happened? You lost the game.
Well, maybe a bit of a difference, and I agree that they were trying to play that shutdown style that they did against the Rangers with great success. But as you mentioned, they had that extra cushion. But it didn't feel like they were generating chances, save for the Callahan breakaway in the third period. But they had a stretch of 8.5 minutes in the first period. You mentioned it, Leah, 13.5 minutes in the second period where they didn't get a shot. And I think Chicago just weathered that early storm, knowing that the home team, Tampa, excited coming out, were going to come with everything, guns a-blazing, and they did the first minute on. They were really, really good. And then they sort of got through that, and then they just were a poised team that started moving the puck really well. And as you said, all of a sudden you turn around and a minute 58, bang, bang, the game's over. So it was a very, I think, a very disciplined, poised, experienced performance by Chicago. And I think maybe Tampa was a little bit guilty of trying to shut it down too much and sitting back too much, more so than they might have done in that New York series.
Yeah, because it's easier said than done, but the way they started the game, you know, if you could play
it was terrific.
That, yeah, so I mean, I know you can't, Chicago Blackhawks aren't going to let you play that way 60 minutes every game, but wow, I mean, home ice advantage, and they came out, and they could have had another goal before Killorn got that first one, and they just did, they were just the way they look about it, getting, you know, on the puck quicker, deflections, you name it, close, and then as you guys are, as we're chatting about, these droughts of not even getting a single shot.
And Killorn's goal wasn't, it was a great play by Killorn, the hand eye to deflect the puck wider than that, a fluttering puck way wider than that to put it in. But it's not what you call a quality scoring chance.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah. They had droughts of shots, and even the goal they got wasn't from a quote-unquote great chance.
You know, and you're talking about Tampa Bay and the fact that they sat back, and after the hockey game, many of the players on Tampa spoke to that fact, including Brendan Morrow, and he said there's a fine line between respect and fear. I think we respect them. You can't fear them. It looked like in the third we were holding on, and that fear of what might be coming. So what has Tampa learned from this? Not only their players, but also perhaps their coaching staff.
Well, you know, it'd be interesting to chat with Glenn Healy as well, because I am curious about Stamkos not being on. I know he played a long shift, but and Glenn pointed that out about getting your best guys out when the goaltender was pulled. But I think in Tampa, look, Chicago is the gold standard. So in Tampa's case, what you did against the Detroit Red Wings was a learning lesson. New York Rangers, you thought the Rangers had the advantage in Game 7 from experience, and Tampa, you know, won up that as well. So I think it'd be a quick learn. I think Brendan Morrow, I like his candor, because I think he's right that way about, you know, all of a sudden this is a different animal here. Okay, this is a different kettle of fish, the Chicago Blackhawks. So we've got to learn that what worked with New York and successfully for them isn't going to be good enough here. And you got to learn it by next game. Otherwise, you don't want a 15-year drought like he had for other guys not making it to the final. And one thing about Tampa, they've been a quick read.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what you learn from it is you got to spend more time in their zone. And the sitting back, the rope-a-dope, they played a lot of a 1-3-1 alignment through that neutral zone at times, really trying to clog it up. But you're playing against a team, and you watch the Keese, you watch the Seabrooks, how good they are at moving the puck through that, regardless of getting the forwards, getting some momentum through the neutral zone and the perfect pass. And that kind of a neutral zone clog, if you will, it works when you can intercept the passes and you don't allow any kind of flow, but Chicago still found a way to get through it.
You know, I was watching the game with Mark Osborne, we're doing it on radio last night, I was thinking about the day the music died for Guy Boucher was when Philadelphia had the puck and nobody in Tampa pressed the zone, right? And I thought about it. I said, are they kind of playing that way? I mean, it was never the same after that Peter Laviolette, they basically said, what is this, guys? You're playing like the prevent defense. And here now, to a degree, you've got the highest scoring team during the regular season. And I don't know, you reacted. So I think the same thing. Like it brought up memories of, I thought, a distant time gone by.
And it's kind of funny because you go into the series and you talk about all the skill, all the speed on both sides, and you're thinking, and the way they both teams can move the puck really, really well and stretch the goalies out, that you're thinking you're going to go in and see maybe a 5-4, 6-5 kind of game. Instead, you got one team that's playing British Bulldog standing on the blue line and waiting for the other one to come through. So it was kind of a lunch bag letdown to...
Thank you.
Your old show, lunch bag letdown when you watch that game unfold.
And on the flip side of that game, you speak of it unfolding and Tampa's start and what they were able to do when they first came out. They were all over Chicago, and this game could have been a much different story if it wasn't for the play of Corey Crawford, who just continually silently gets this done. Yes, 22 saves last night, but, you know, when you think about Crawford, for some reason, he just never gets put in the same category as, say, the Carey Prices, the Henrik Lundqvist of the world. But yet, he was spectacular last night for his club. He's going for his second cup in 3 years. Why does Crawford not get the credit that these other goaltenders do? Is it because there's not as many warts on his team or the team in front of him? Or
Well, Ben Bishop's kind of facing what Corey Crawford did a couple of years ago now, that it's, you know, it's like the Patrick Waugh's of the world, the Marty Brodeurs of the world. There's certain guys that the goaltenders were the story. Like, they won the Stanley Cup, and modern day would be Price and Lundqvist that starts there. And a couple of years ago, when he won the Cup, we were all dissecting every shot on him. This guy won the Cup, and everyone was dumping on, oh, you're weak here, you're weak there.
But that's my point. It just seems that he's always just, you know, just getting nailed on, even though he's been so strong for this team.
Well, and Detroit went through it with different goaltenders winning cups, right, until Hasek was there. You know, just, you know, Curtis Joseph couldn't thrive there. You know, just it's funny about that. So it's kind of like, unless you're maybe drafted by the organization, built that way. Otherwise, it's an Antti Niemi 1 year, him another year, and they just think you're almost doing the NHL version of rent a goalie. And that's unfair to Crawford.
I just think that he hasn't been flawless. And somebody made the comparison to, and I look at Grant Fuhr as being one of the greats of the day for all the victories that he had in Stanley Cups and Canada Cups. But he also allowed a lot of goals, but he knew how to close the door at the right time. And somebody made that comparison of Crawford to a Grant Fuhr, that he may give up three or four, but when you need it most, he's going to give you that big save to close the door and allow you to win that game. And so I think when you look at a Lundqvist, you look at a Price, and ironically that Bishop beat both of those, but, and I think Bishop's riding the same kind of wave that Crawford is that they aren't the goalie that you look at, even though Bishop did pitch a couple of shutouts, is going to be that guy that is going to be near flawless every single night. No, he'll give up a couple. He'll give a couple that may make you want to shake your head a little bit and say, should we be taking him out of there? Instead, He locks it down at the right time.
And you talk about locking down. No bigger save than the one on Callahan, which then turned around and was the start of creating Chicago's first goal last night.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny. You look at recent Stanley Cup champions. I mean, Tim Thomas was in his glory when they beat Vancouver. Jonathan Quick had the great, you know, his goaltending run was credited with the LA Kings winning their two Stanley Cups. But in Corey Crawford's case, he's the one guy, yeah, that's lacking that same kind of props for a Stanley Cup.
Well, and Crawford's almost like Osgood in Detroit. You win Stanley Cups, but the feeling at the end of it is they didn't win because of the goaltender. When you look at New York and their body of success, you say they won because of the goaltender at times, not Stanley Cups recently. And certainly Montreal are a good team during the regular season because of the goaltender. And at the end of it all, when you look at the team, Chicago wins the Cup, do you say, well, Crawford was good, but he wasn't the reason why. And maybe that's why he doesn't get the props.
And you talk about all those pieces in front of him, and one of those pieces is Jonathan Toews. Toews and Kane last night held off the score sheet, but there was a moment there, I believe it was in the second period, where you saw the captain, the Chicago Blackhawks, on the bench just giving it to his team. And you want to talk about leadership, you want to talk about getting a team going. I was scared of him sitting at home through the TV screen, but he was gunned up and he was telling his boys, it's time to go.
Well, we're just seeing it on the TV side there. And he did step up a couple of times during the night where he's just saying to them, come on, guys, we got to get going. We got to show up. We got to get this thing done. And, that's the sign of a great leader.
Eyes on that guy right there. I mean, yeah.
Well, it's interesting having Mark Messier as part of our TV part of the broadcast, and you want to bring in that intangible. And first of all, nowadays, I wonder if guys are aware of the final. There's like 30 cameras on them. So you got clips of Bickle describing how he's not feeling well. You know, just every little thing's being caught about a guy thinking someone bit him or whatever. And in that case with Jonathan Toews, you saw this was a sluggish Chicago Blackhawk team. And he wasn't being a showboat, right? It's just the little kind of thing about guys, we got to pick it up a notch. And not a great game for them, but they win.
Well, and you think about a year ago when they were struggling early in the playoffs, and the guys showed it last night on the broadcast, where Toews gets frustrated, takes a penalty, he's in the box, he's really PO'd and down, and who is it? Seabrook goes over, has a few words with him, and it was kind of a turning point in their playoffs last spring. So he's the leader, but there's a great leadership group on that team when you think of Seabrook and Keith at the back end, and then a Toews up front, and other guys who do it in a quieter way, a Kane who can turn a game around with just how explosive he can be offensively. I look at Hossa last night, had a couple of shifts where he just took the puck and was dominant, and then defensively was physically dominant. Brandon Saad, I think, is going to evolve into being a Hossa type of player, terrific to watch.
And then the fact is, so many of these players in Chicago, we talk about their experience, and they have it, but the one that doesn't is the young 20-year-old, Teuvo Teravainen. But he came out last night, a two-point game for him, including a goal. What did you see from the young man on the ice? Marion Hossa, speaking of him, said he's finished cool.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. That's understated cool, I guess, is what it would be. And I really liked watching him play in the playoffs, you know, because it goes back to having to retool the team constantly. And you look at the goal last night was from their big free agent pickup or a big trade deadline pickup one. And then a guy who was a first round pick a couple of years ago that you're not picking in the top three.
And both healthy
anymore.
Scratches
yeah,
in the Western Conference final.
Absolutely. But you mix those pieces in. And, you know, I like last year, Montreal did that well with Rene Bork, for example. Healthy scratch, big goal, you know, that kind of stuff. And here, now he's the young guy, so the future is unlimited that way, but you don't get to pick second or third anymore like getting Kane and Toews. So if you're going to replenish it looks like it, well, whatever he was, 18th overall, I mean, this guy is a real deal NHLer.
Well, and you don't win with 20 players, and that's become a bit of a cliche now, but you win because you have depth and you have the ability, if you're the coach, to wheel guys in and out when, and especially with a younger player, to give them that opportunity to maybe to sit back and watch a game and retool and figure things out. And but the skill level and the ability, and there's that next wave. And everybody talking about this maybe being a last hurrah for Chicago because of the contract situations and the salary cap. Well, the core group's not going anywhere, and you've got some young guys like this on the come. They're going to be good for a while. Maybe they're going to have to move a good piece or two out of there to make it all work, but they've got some good pieces coming in, and he scores a nice goal with the deflection, standing in the front of that, going to the right place, and then forces the turnover on Vermette's goal, the ultimate game winner.
And you look at the fact that Teuvo Teravainen comes out and he adds to the score sheet. Vermette does the same thing. Those are guys outside of their top six. Now, Tampa has relied so much on their top six for their offense. And I think we saw last night, if they can't get their bottom two lines going, they might not be able to do the offensive numbers that we've seen against a team like the Chicago Blackhawks.
Well, you need the three lines going, the four lines going, absolutely. And it's funny. Generally, against the Rangers, there would be a surprise guy or two that scored for Tampa Bay. But a lot of teams, Vancouver struggled for years about being a one-line team offensively, trying to get a second line going. So here in Tampa's case, I think it's a bonus when you look, your best player, your superstar, isn't on your best line. So that gives you some balance. But when you're playing Chicago, just having two lines of offense won't cut it.
We talk about balance, and the guy that balances out our broadcast on Hockey Night in Canada is the one who stands between the benches, and that is Glenn Healy, who joins us now here on Hockey Central at noon. Glenn, how are you doing, first of all? It's been a long road for you, my friend.
Yeah, I'm not a big shot like you guys, though. I just walked by the park, by the rink, and there's a bunch of big, huge screens where the fans watch the games, and you're on.
Wow.
Big shots all across Tampa.
Oh, yeah, that's how we feel around here.
So what do you think of Gorge?
Yeah, exactly. What do you think of the coral on Gorge?
Well, it's very Tampa East.
With the lights off?
All right, Hill. So here you go. Game one of the Stanley Cup Final, and Chicago skates away with it. And it's usually a feeling out period at the first initial concept of a series. But what did you perhaps notice in between those benches, personnel-wise, between these two teams, whether it be a matchup or, you know, just minutes the guys were playing, that either you liked and you see progressing going forward or perhaps changing?
Well, a couple things. Some nights you paint a Picasso. They painted a barn. That was a dud. An absolute. Our super slow-mo pack wasn't in super slow-mo. That was actually live. That was real time. Chicago's one of those teams that if you keep them hanging around, if Tampa goes 8 minutes in the first without a shot and 13 minutes in the third period without a shot and it's a 1-0 game, to me, you're playing against a dangerous opponent that knows how to get it done in the postseason. And sitting back was not a good idea for Tampa Bay. And shoulda, woulda, coulda, the one that got away, I'm sure that's what they all feel today. And if I'm Tampa, I'm going to make some changes. First off, Steven Stamkos, does John Cooper know how good Steven Stamkos is? Because he sure doesn't play him enough. And he better adjust that, or it's going to be a pretty quick final. But Tampa's a team that has found a way to rebound in games where they have been not so good. They did it against the Rangers. They did it against Detroit. And I would expect a much better effort from both teams on Saturday.
I like the goaltender in Chicago analogy about painting a barn, because that was always the Glenn Hall story years ago for missing training camp. He was painting his barn in Alberta. So hopefully they paint something a little better in game number two. And on Stamkos, you know, you talked about the end of the game, and I am curious about, because I can remember years ago you and Craig Simpson picked up on when Sidney Crosby didn't go at the end of the game, the Winter Classic, you know, having that head shot, and he wasn't awake to go out there when they pulled the goaltender. I know Stamkos came off balance about the long shift we heard he came off of versus not being out there when they pulled the goaltender last night.
All right. Healy dropped out from Tampa.
Okay. That's it. I startled him. We'll get him
you
back.
You did. It was your shirt. It just made him a little.
That could be it.
But, you know, do you guys agree with that this was a dud of the first game of the Stanley Cup Final?
We were talking about it off air. That just underwhelmed after all the excitement, all the buildup.
Sorry, guys. Apparently,
superstars
back here. Heels, are you back with us? Do we have you?
I'm back, yes. I was just telling Gord, next trick. Nice story. Stamkos is one of those guys, when he works out with Gary Roberts in the summer, he's the benchmark of absolutely every single physical test they do. What did Stammer get? I got to beat it. What's his 40 time? I got to beat it. And so I'm not buying that. He should be on the ice. Goalie's out. Game's on the line. There's Ryan Callahan is your answer? No, thank you. They've got to have a better answer. And to me, him not being on the ice is something that is significant. And, you know, one of the reasons why, when you look at even the ice time during the game, probably the fifth lowest or five other players up front in Tampa had more ice than him. It just can't happen. It can't happen. And maybe it's time to move him back to center and move Filppula down and kind of readdress the way the lines go. I don't know if that'll happen, but it would be an option for me if I'm John Cooper.
I know you talked about it a little bit last night, Heels, and we showed some clips of Jonathan Toews on the bench doing a lot of talking. Did we see a great leader at work last night?
Yeah, he's not patient for inconsistency or a lack of that kind of push, because he understands how hard it is to get to the final. He understands how hard it is to raise the 34.5-pound trophy. He's a pretty, you know, smart guy in this game, and their game just wasn't there last night. You know, we talked about it at times at 12 shots, 13 shots. That's not the Chicago team to me. When they played Anaheim, Anaheim to me is the best team in the NHL. And they absolutely schooled them. They made them look so human and so non-Anaheim-like through the team that I saw through the regular season. And then you come up against Tampa, and I get there's a feeling out process. I get you haven't played your opponent. I get it takes time. But he understood, you know, we could play 11 minutes and win a hockey game. It's all we have to play. And that's what they did. They actually played less than 11. They played 2, and they won a hockey game. And now they're 3 wins closer. So he's one of those guys who, you know, understands that this is how you have to play in June. It's not April. It's not a preseason game. It's not a November game. This is a game in June where 28 other teams are watching us, and don't let the moment pass us. And they didn't. They played a minute and 58. They got a goal from a guy who started the year in the AHL and a goal from a guy who was totally insignificant in Arizona. Their stars didn't even have to play, and they won a game. And that's a significant, you know, kind of bullet for Tampa Bay.
Well, how much of that lack of shots and lack of offense, if you will, was part of Tampa scoring early and then basically sitting back and trying to protect it?
Yeah, good start for Tampa. Like, scoring chances were basically 5-1 with 12 minutes gone in the game, and then the next 6 scoring chances were Chicago. And if you break the game down, Chicago would probably say we took over for the last 53 minutes of the hockey game. They decided to sit back, and we didn't. But, you know, Chicago's power play was, you know, inconsistent, mm-hmm. didn't really create momentum, actually lost them some momentum. But, you know, the bottom line is, and maybe this is fatigue a little bit, you know, the emotional game 7, you had it Saturday, you went home Sunday, you had to leave again Monday to get here to listen to all us scribes talk and ask stupid questions to all the players. And so maybe part of it was that. But they've got a couple days now, and they'll get a much better game going. And I would imagine Tampa would do the same. The stakes now become that much higher that, you know, one team is up 1-0.
You know, you mentioned about Tampa making some tweaks and are saying they should play, lobbying for Stamkos playing more. And the Chicago side, after 2 periods, 40 minutes, you know, we're looking at the ice time. I was doing the game on radio with Mark Osborne. And, you know, you really saw, I mean, a guy like Brandon Saad almost had triple the minutes of the guys that ended up scoring the 2 goals to tie and win the game. Do you think Joel might try to roll the lines a little more depth-wise, like he did in the 3rd period, but didn't seem to do as much in the first 2?
No, I don't think so. I think Joel has very little patience at times for some of his players. And that's a good thing if you're a player, because if I'm on the bench, I want you to play the guys that are going to get me that best result. And, you know, not to discredit Teravainen, who had a pretty good game, a 2-goal game, but if I was to go back over the tape, could I find a replay where I'd say, wow, he was on it? We saw some Hossa replays where you went, this guy was dominant in 200 feet of ice. Didn't really see one for Teravainen, but who cares? I mean, healthy scratch, you guys had mentioned, through the playoffs. But the bottom line is they won the game, and 2 guys that you didn't expect to score did, and the big boys were off the sheet. So I would think they're going to go out and play more of their team game, which I didn't think they did in game 1. It's going to be more about this is how we have to play. We didn't get it done in game 1. We got the result, but we're going to be better for 2.
Are we at a point where we can stop talking about Duncan Keith in 30 minutes in Chicago and 4 defense?
Because it really is. He played under 30 last night.
We have 29. Because it's really not a factor.
Well, how many times? Yeah, this is what I used to love when we used to play Gretzky. It'd be like, okay, let's hit him. Really? Don't think other teams had thought of that? It didn't work. Couldn't catch him. And same with Duncan Keith. You look at him. I mean, he's been hit so few times in the playoffs compared to other players. Jarmelson, for instance. He's been hit well over 80 times in the playoffs, and Duncan Keith at 50-something. So the minutes are there for him. He gets a couple days between 1 and 2. The stakes are really big. Athletes today, gone are the days, and this is a good lesson for Toronto fans, gone are the days of skating 4 times in the summer and I work out 3 times a week. No, Phil, That's not what guys do when they play in June. Guys that play in June do exactly what Duncan Keith is doing, and the minutes are there. He's, you know, kind of three wins away from doing the probably the best thing he'll ever do, which is put his name on the cup forever. And I don't think it's a factor. He doesn't look tired to me. He sat beside me for 2/3 of the game last night, and when you look at him, he looks like Brian Leetch when I played with Brian. Never seems to pant after a shift. Never seems to look tired. Never seems to look like he's any sense of panic or distress.
All right, Hill, since game one was a dud, what do you expect in game two Saturday when you do it for HNIC?
A stud. That's what we're looking for. I think it's going to be a much better game. They're just, you know, you're coming off a two totally different series, one where Anaheim was trying to beat the snot out of Chicago, and same with the Rangers, the shot-blocking team that relied on a goaltender that played almost that same system, and now you've got two teams that are this is a kind of a car race, not a demolition derby. And so I expect it to be a really fast game. The minutes are going to go up for the Stars. The stakes are going to be a little bit greater. And 2 days off, teams can adjust, readjust, and figure out what they didn't do in game one, what they have to do in game two. So it's going to be a much better match for sure.
Well, it's coming after a big horse race, so maybe the horse will be out of that painted barn you referred to earlier. But Leah asked the question of us, Heels, and I'll ask it of you. Corey Crawford, he gets the job done, but we don't talk about him the way people talk about a Carey Price or a Lundqvist or a Pekka Rinne, yet he's the guy that more often than not is still standing when they're playing the deepest in June. Why does he not get the recognition?
It is so true in a lot of ways. You know, how you win a Stanley Cup and you don't get credit, how you could be Rodney Dangerfield is kind of really beyond me. I mean, part of it has to do with the fact that Darling had to close out that first series a little bit. But since that, he has been nothing but lights out. And, you know, even the Detroit series, you could say, all right, he gave up two or more in all seven games. Okay, fine. But that's a team that plays, you know, not with the kind of the defensive aspect in mind. These are star players that play in front of them that want to play with the puck and want to go. They want to play on that edge, and maybe they give up some chances that they shouldn't give up. But last night, early on, it was all him. And if it had got to 2-0, I don't think Chicago wins the game. I think Tampa finds a way to feel really comfortable in their skin. At 1-0, you know, when it took them 13 minutes in the third to get a shot, they weren't comfortable. You could see it on the bench, and Chicago knew the door was open. So give Crawford a lot of credit for game one because, you know, as much as you look at Teravainen with his 2 points and you look at the effort that Toews put to bring the leadership group together, Corey Crawford was the reason it stayed at 1-0 and gave them a chance.
All right, well, we look forward to hearing from you between the benches, Glenn, when Game 2 rolls out on Hockey Night in Canada, courtesy of CBC, 7 o'clock Eastern. Remember that start time, 4 o'clock Pacific. Heels, now go enjoy the sunshine. You earned it, my friend.
Thank you very much, guys, and keep up the good work. And just remember, you're stars down here in Florida. You're everywhere.
I feel like there's some sarcasm in that comment a little bit.
Well, yeah, well, there's always something with
sarcasm
Heels.
Sarcasm from Healy. I can't imagine it.
Not in Tampa, but I'm feeling the heat.
Yeah. Well, he can't get much sun either with that fair complexion.
Aww, so he's got listen, the 2 off days. It's okay to be fair. It happens to the
Understood.
Best of us. It keeps us young looking, we hope at least. All
he's
right.
The only guy in Tampa Bay wearing a kilt today. I can guarantee you that.
All right. We're going to have a little bit more game one talk from the Stanley Cup final. But, you know, when the Stanley Cup rolls around, you know, Commissioner Gary Bettman will be on hand. And he did address the media yesterday. And a few points of interest came out of that conversation, including perhaps one of the marquee franchises on the sale block, as well as expansion. Yes, Vegas, baby. We have more on Hockey Central at noon on the Sportsnet radio and television networks and the NHL Network when we return.
Now Jeff Blair can tell you bedtime stories. Subscribe to podcasts of The Jeff Blair Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher and listen anytime you want. Sweet dreams. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now, more Hockey Central on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Ooh, welcome you back into Hockey Central at noon on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network and the NHL Network south of the border in the United States. Leah Hextall alongside Gord Stellick and Hall of Famer Scott Morrison. And Scott, it sounds like you're going to have some new company in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, an exciting day. And I can remember when I got a phone call, I think it was 9 years ago now, that I was receiving the Elmer Ferguson Award from the Hockey Hall of Fame and going to have my plaque in there. And a couple of phone calls today. Exciting calls for some good friends of ours that we've known for many, many years. And in fact, one, Bob McKenzie, who Bob and I started out at the same time, our careers. He was freelancing at the Toronto Star and I was at the Toronto Sun. And our first assignments, I remember, I'll never forget the day, was a minor hockey tournament at St. Mike's Arena, GTHL Championship. And Bob and I were there and he went on with the hockey news and, of course, TSN and Bob announced today as the recipient of the Elmer Ferguson Award and very, very deserving. So congratulations to him and another guy that, Gord, we've known for many, many years. And 35 years as the radio voice of the Los Angeles Kings. Nick Nixon is the winner of the Foster Hewitt Award for the broadcast side. So congratulations to both, richly deserving, and look forward to the induction ceremonies on November 9.
What did it feel like? What did it really feel like, Scott, when you got that phone call that you were going into the Hall of Fame? And more so, what it feels like when you walk into it and you know that you're a part of that great institution?
Yeah, it was an amazing experience when I got that call. And I remember it was at the Stanley Cup Finals, Edmonton, Carolina. And I was at Edmonton that day and the phone rang that morning. And it's one of those ones where you are absolutely speechless. Your knees buckle a little bit and you go, wow. I mean, and you hear the players say it, and it's similar for media people, is you don't get into the business thinking that that's the end goal. You get in it because you love what you're doing, and you're blessed enough to be able to cover this great game at this level, and then to get that recognition. And what's significant is it's the recognition of your peers, and that means a tremendous amount. And the ceremony is incredible when you put that jacket, that blazer on for the first time. Is an incredible feeling, and then to be able to go back with your son and to be able to show your plaque there. And when people come up and they say, geez, we saw your plaque in the Hockey Hall of Fame, that's a pretty special feeling.
You speak of the Hockey Hall of Fame and seeing that plaque. I only went to the Hall of Fame probably for the first time about 7 or 8 years ago, and my grandfather's in it, Brian Hextall. And the first time I saw him on his plaque and Gordie Howe's right next to him and all these other greats, and you can't help but get emotional when you walk into that building, and especially when you get into the great hall where all the plaques are. But it truly is, if you're a hockey person, even if you're not, you become overcome with emotion because it really is just such a testament to the work and the tradition.
Well, it's something the NHL has really done right, the new Hall of Fame. For years ago, it was where the Canadian National Exhibition is in Toronto, and it was just, everything was in storage, and they finally get it the kind of home, commensurate with the other professional sports halls of fame. And you're right, you can go, there's the interactive games and all these other things for the kids, but then when you go into the Great Hall, it just, there is a mystique about it that just you take a look and you got to slow down and just read. And there's some big names that get you. And then there's some other names that kind of draw a smile and you read about them and that. So that is certainly very impressive. And congratulations to the two additions for sure.
Yeah. When you go into the hall, visiting the hall as opposed to going into the hall, you really just get an appreciation for the history of the game and you just walk around and there's just a feeling there when you see the trophies up close, you see the Stanley Cup. I mean, that trophy, all the championship trophies and all the sports are special, but that one just has a presence to it like no other. And then you see the people that are in there and the people that have been fortunate enough to carry it and all the rest of it. It's a really cool experience. And if you haven't done it, do it, because beyond that, they've got interactive games and all the rest of the stuff that is a fun part of the venture as well. But just feeling that history and all of that in that room is just something unique.
Well, other news coming out of the National Hockey League yesterday, and it caught me a little bit by surprise, is that Mario Lemieux and Ron Burkle, co-owners of the Pittsburgh Penguins, are deciding to take a look. They've hired a group, Morgan Stanley, who helped facilitate the sale of the Buffalo Sabres to the Pegula family, and they've decided to hire them to look at their business interests and perhaps selling the franchise. And at that point, we welcome in on Hockey Central at noon, Rob Rossi of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. He's a lead sports columnist. And Rob, this surprised me yesterday, but I'm wondering, sir, if it surprised you.
No, no, it didn't. I started hearing rumblings of this a year ago, that Lemieux and Burkle were interested in maybe liquidating, if not all, certainly a large portion of their equity in the franchise. I think there's a couple of things here to keep in mind. One, this was never an ownership group that wanted to make this their life's work. Mario Lemieux brought Ron Burkle in because he needed some actual money to put along with the money that was owed him into a share to keep the team in Pittsburgh so that he could get paid the contract that was owed him in the 90s. And really, I think this would have happened a decade ago, but the Penguins won a lottery, and that lottery changed their lives. I mean, Sidney Crosby's arrival turned this franchise into one that was probably at some point destined to move into one that got not only a great arena for them, but also redevelopment to the site of the old arena, and it's been a license to print money in some ways. So Ron Burkle had told the Penguins going into Consol Energy Center that he would reevaluate his ownership stake 5 years in. That was last summer. I'm told they see that there's a bubble right now to sell teams and maximize on profit, and I think they want to make sure that they do the right thing by their investors to do that now.
You know, Rob, it's interesting. Your perspective is a lot of people wonder why Mario would be getting out. But like you say, a lot of people wondered why he stayed in. And had they not won the lottery ball, he would have been out a lot earlier for sure. And I'm just wondering, when the lockout ended, like Ron Burkle was viewed as one of these shining white knight armor, you know, and armors for the owner side and helping trying to solve it. Pittsburgh looked like a model franchise. It looked like we are the world. The ownership group got along. Ray Sherrill got along. Dan Bylsma got along. Sidney Crosby. Stanley Cups were in the offing. I mean, what has exactly happened behind the scenes as far as the relationships with there? I know a couple are gone now, but the relationships on the ownership side.
I don't think Ron and Mario are at odds, but I certainly don't think they are on the same page in terms of some of the hockey decisions. I know what the Penguins have said publicly and really pushed behind the scenes, but I'm told Mario Lemieux never wanted to fire Ray Shiro last year, but Ron wanted Ray to report directly to David Morehouse, who's the CEO, and Ray didn't want to amend his contract to do that, so Mario didn't get his way. And you know, Mario, to be fair to Ron, had backed Ray when Ray decided to retain Dan Bylsma after the 2013 sweep in the conference final against Boston. So, you know, I think in many ways Ron pulled a little bit of his stroke last summer. Their heart doesn't seem in it to me anymore. I have never seen Mario Lemieux around less than he has been this year. His kids are grown up. That was a big draw for him. He could bring his kids to the arena, and it was a real family event. You know, Mario's got homes in many places, including a large one just outside of Montreal. I think he wants to divide his time between Pittsburgh, Montreal, and Florida. And I think they feel like this is the right time for somebody new, somebody with a fresh perspective to come in. So when that happens, I think it won't be long once this team is sold. And I expect it to be sold. I don't think they went this far without being pretty confident they were going to get an offer of somewhere between $600 and $700 million, which I think is what it would take. I think once the team's sold, you'll see within a year a new general manager, a new head coach, a new CEO, and a whole new look to the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Is there any sense, Rob, of an interested party or group at this point?
Well, the way they do things in Pittsburgh, I guess we could look at Sidney Crosby, right? you know, and maybe I'm only half joking about that. I think there are a few people in Pittsburgh that have ties to the local community that might be part of a group of people. I don't feel comfortable yet because I haven't had enough people tell me, but I will say there are some guys that are working in the NHL whose names we would recognize that I think would be interested in getting this. And I don't mean that those people right now are league executives, but there are a few prominent guys with ties to Mario Lemieux and Sidney Crosby who might be able to put together an ownership group and who might know a lot of people with a lot of money. So you can read between the lines there.
Well, we don't have 600 to 700 million, so we're out, Rob. But we thank you for your time in illuminating us on what's going on when it comes to the Pittsburgh Penguins and the fact that it looks like there's a for sale sign on them. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
All right, Rob Rossi of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, their lead sports columnist. But the Pittsburgh franchise wasn't the only one making some noise. Gary Bettman was talking about expansion, and it looks like Bill Foley, who has the interest in taking a team to Las Vegas, his ticket drive has gone quite well to date, a little over about 11.5 when it comes to ticket sales. Bettman is going to take it to the Board of Governors on June 24th, present it, and then at that point, if the Board of Governors give the green light, he's going to do the formal process for expansion. Doesn't mean that that's for sure, but I want to get your guys' thoughts, because at one point we were sitting there going, maybe Vegas, but now it seems like it's coming more to the forefront.
Well, and it seems like they want to get ahead of the curve, making a big splash in a big venue in the United States, you know, because San Jose, I don't quite count the same way, with all due respect, Anaheim and the Disney Group all those years ago. So, yeah, I mean, on the NBA side, up in Canada, when they expanded to Toronto, they wouldn't allow Proline, the local lottery, you know, to have NBA games listed their way. So that's a long way from going to Las Vegas, where that goes part and parcel with the sports books there. But this is one of those stories, Scott, that has legs for very good reasons, because it has legs. It's not speculative, and they've moved the awards there. They've done a lot of things there, and it seems like they want to be first in.
Yeah, I was going to say, it feels like the NHL wants Vegas as much as Bill Foley wants the NHL. And we'll see, I guess, ultimately how this plays out. What's the cost going to be for an expansion franchise? How many hundreds of millions is it going to take to get that? 11,500 deposits, whatever you want to call them, doesn't feel like a big number to me. I'd be more impressed if it was 20,000 and a significant deposit, because it's easy to sit there and say, now, yeah, I'm kind of interested, as opposed to at some point when you've got to stroke the real check. So put me on the cynical side a little bit, I guess, on this one, that not feeling that that's the kind of support you need to make that kind of a plunge. But if somebody's willing to stroke the check, then you know there's going to be interest.
Here's my question, and this is something that always seems to come to mind for me when we talk about expansion past the 30 teams, is that not all 30 teams are healthy. And Bettman addressed Arizona yesterday. He also addressed Florida, said that they're not relocating anywhere. We have teams that aren't healthy. So why are we looking, or why is the National Hockey League looking to expand?
Well, there's always, you know, I remember talking to Bob Goodnow about this years ago, because that was always the argument they threw at the NHL Players Association, and you know, about wanting a cap and other things. And, you know, Bob just said that's, you know, that's their deal. It's cyclical. St. Louis is in terrible shape, then it's not. You know, you get new owners in. Then if you want to move Hartford to Carolina, do it. If you want to move Minnesota to Dallas, do it. And then have an expansion team there. That's up to you. You know, you've got to figure out the 30 best spots or 32 best spots, like a McDonald's or Burger King franchise, you know, where to put them. And it's always going to be an ongoing scenario. There's ups and downs, just like businesses go. And then expansion's always a plus. The expansion money, they like to divvy up, but it also grows in other markets. And they've, you know, look at all these teams that also win Stanley Cups that have been new expansion teams.
Yeah, I mean, to Gord's point, if you've got owners in the markets that are suffering a little bit, and they're willing to ride it out and incur losses to go through the cycle, if they can indeed get through the cycle, then the found money that you get from expansion, that's how you grow your business, and that's what the owners want, is new money.
Well, at one point, the Tampa Bay Lightning, they were considered a non-traditional market. They were an expansion team, and look at them now. They're in the Stanley Cup final. They are down a game after dropping it to the Chicago Blackhawks by a 2-1 decision. We're going to see Game 2 go on Saturday in Tampa Bay at Amalie Arena. You can catch that Hockey Night in Canada on CBC. It's a 7 o'clock Eastern start, 4 o'clock Pacific.
Can I do one more shout-out?
Absolutely.
Heels mentioning how big we are in Tampa. We're bigger than that. Alan Adams, a veteran hockey writer with the Canadian Press, who's now doing some PR work and whatnot, sent me a text the other day that he's been watching us on a podcast, or listening to us on a podcast, in Baku, Azerbaijan, where he's at the European game. So we are worldwide. It's somewhere on the other side of the world. It's a long ways away. So that's how big we are.
Do they want an expansion team?
Probably.
Real quick, guys, does Tampa even the series in game 2?
I'll say yes.
I would agree.
All right. Well, we will have to wait and see. I agree as well. I think we're going to have 1-1 as the series just back
to Chicago.
We can
change our mind tomorrow
on
now.
Monday. Exactly. But come Saturday, it will be Game 2. Hockey Night in Canada, CBC at 7 o'clock. For Hall of Famer Scott Morrison, Gord Stellick, Leah Hextall, you've been listening to Hockey Central at Noon on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network and the NHL Network south of the border. Have yourself a wonderful Thursday afternoon.